Welcome to Catholic Morality and the Catechism. Monsignor William Smith talks about things our society would sometimes rather not discuss. Moral conscience, virtues, and the Ten Commandments. Here's Monsignor Smith.
Hello, I'm Monsignor Smith. I teach moral theology at St. Joseph's Seminary, Dunwoody, which is the seminary for the Archdiocese of New York. In this series, we have been examining the moral teaching of the Catholic Church, as it is contained and presented in the Catechism, the New Catechism of the Catholic Church, Part 3, Life in Christ. At first, we looked at some fundamental issues that are basic to all morality. Then, progressively, we have been examining the outline of the Ten Commandments as they are presented here in the Catechism. This time, we'd like to focus on the fifth commandment, Thou shalt not kill. I doubt in this overview whether we can cover all the things that we should hear, but it is an important, very important commandment. We see, basically, and we've made the point before, that we should try to read this catechism with a copy of the Bible next to us, and in some cases some very important documents of the Church as well, for extension, for fullness. The catechism was first published in French in November of 1992, and we didn't get an English translation or an adequate English translation until 1994. And the present Holy Father issued an encyclical called The Gospel of Life, Evangelium Vitae, on March 25, 1995. So that's too late to be included in the Catechism. But I would suggest very strongly that when somebody reads or studies this fifth commandment, that they also, as a companion piece, include this very extensive encyclical called The Gospel of Life from the present Pope, because it is very thorough. And there are some formal statements made there that are the strongest statements ever made in the history of the Catholic Church. In fact, the Holy Father analyzes very thoroughly, together with all the bishops, because on that one he asked all the bishops of the world to send in their suggestions and to make suggestions about what should be done with that encyclical, and several thousand of them did. And some of the Pope's expressions have now become really contemporary. He speaks of the fact that we are moving away from a culture of life into a culture of death. And there are people who don't particularly like the Pope, or don't particularly like the Church, or particularly don't like this particular teaching of the Catholic Church, but I notice that nobody denies the analysis that the Holy Father presents about where we are and where we're headed. Even things like the New Republic and the Nation and some other publications, which are not known outposts of the Vatican, no one says he's wrong about the description of what's going on. What does he do? He does, and he approaches it the way he approaches all things. First, he goes back to Holy Scripture. And what he does, as the Catechism first cites, he goes back to Genesis 4, in this case. That's the Cain and Abel event, and begins to analyze it. And it's obviously the fruit of a long meditation on his part. He did not sit down at a word processor and just do a little word search for killing or Cain or Abel. This is the reflection of a lot of study and thoughtful prayer. And I have read Genesis 4. I'm sure you have read Genesis 4. Everyone's a little bit familiar with Cain and Abel. But that first section of Evangelium Vitae is extremely important, and it is instructive. Why so? Because some things, basically direct abortion and euthanasia, some things that were universally considered crimes against life as little as 30 years ago, are now being presented as rights or even entitlements, and they have the authority of the state behind them, making these things legal, which causes immediately a double pollution. A double pollution. It pollutes the medical profession, and it pollutes families. The medical profession is a curative profession. It's meant to cure, not to kill. And families, if you think about it, the Pope makes the point, as does the Book of Genesis. The first murder recorded in the Book of Genesis was not outsiders, it was a family event. Cain murdered his brother Abel. And many times, abortion is within a family circle, and euthanasia sometimes is within a family circle. The Pope points out that 100 years ago, one of his predecessors, Pope Leo XIII, in the encyclical Rerum Novarum, had to come to the defense of the workers and their rights because this group of people were being oppressed. And he says the same thing is true today. There's another group of people who are being oppressed, the innocent who are unborn and the innocent who are long born and who are not any longer able to defend themselves. So the Pope says this is part of the Church's social teaching. Now, some people get upset and they say, well, look, this is kind of single issue. There are other things to focus on. Single issue? Do you know of any other single issue that killed 1.55 million Americans last year? That's some singularity. And if the Supreme Court rules the wrong way on assisted suicide, the other end of life will be involved. How did this come about? Pope points out something in his encyclical that helps us to understand this segment about the Fifth Commandment. While going over in number 8 of Evangelium Vitae, the Cain and Abel event, the Cain and Abel narrative, he points out in paragraph 8 that a violation of the Fifth Commandment almost always involves a violation of the Eighth Commandment, that lying and murder are connected. Remember when the Lord God asked Cain, where is your brother? And his answer was deceptive. He says, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? You don't know? Of course he knew. He just left him dead in a field. Notice, he lied. It is a deception. And the Pope points out today, we have a lot of ambiguous medical terminology. We have a lot of ambiguous words that don't really describe what we're talking about. And what we're talking about is killing the innocent. So we have to make sure that our language is accurate and precise and that we don't use a lot of euphemisms, like either terminating a pregnancy or the so-called right to die or whatever kind of wonderful way they want to package these things. What we're talking about is something that is deadly wrong. And it is against the innocent. This is exacerbated by a notion of absolute autonomy, where people think they are so singular that everyone else in their life is to be considered either an enemy against whom they have to defend themselves, or perhaps an alien against whom they have to protect themselves. And that type of absolute autonomy is contributing to what he calls a big cultural shift. The shift from a standard of personal dignity, which requires respect, generosity, and service, to a standard of efficiency, functionality, and usefulness. That's the shift away from the culture of life, where you respect someone simply for what he or she is, and that deserves respect, generosity, and service, to where you begin to value people by their efficiency, their functionality, or their usefulness. Obviously, the unborn are not efficient, they're not functional, and in the judgment of some, they're not useful. Well, the same for the long-born, the elderly who are sick or chronically ill. They're not getting any better, not getting any worse. If we start to measure each other in terms of how useful or functional we are, then the day will come when someone's going to make that judgment about you or about me. And that is the shift with which people who don't agree with the Pope, he says, this is what is happening, this is what shift is taking place, that is what's setting up this culture of death, if you will, and that's what has to be addressed realistically, without tears, without smugness, but with honesty. We want to make sure, as the prophet Isaiah said, woe to him who calls evil good and good evil. We got to call it as it is and speak the truth. We speak the truth in love, but we have to speak the truth. So we go to the beginning, then, of that fifth commandment. It starts, thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not kill, actually, if you go back to Deuteronomy 5:17, it uses a rather rare Hebrew word, rashach. And rashach really means to kill the innocent, to kill the innocent. Actually, in Exodus 20:13, which is the companion, maybe even more explicit, is Exodus 23. Verse 7, which says, do not kill the innocent or the righteous. Technically, that's the quintessential essence of the negative part of the fifth commandment. Never directly take the life of a moral innocent. Never directly take the life of an innocent. This begins with a citation from another document, which is one I think we should memorize because I think it's underneath all of the teaching on the fifth commandment. 2258. Human life is sacred because from its beginning, it is really the creative action of God who is its sole end. God alone is the Lord of life. From its beginning to its end, no one under any circumstance can claim for himself the right to destroy another innocent human being. That's from the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, an instruction called Donum Vitae. Donum Vitae. In Latin, donum is gift, the gift of life. And actually, the title explains the truth, because life is a gift. Life is a gift from God, and we must be convinced about the sacredness of human life. Why is human life sacred? And the first part of this explanation of the fifth commandment, we'll try to explain that. It's not sacred because it's precious. Lots of things are precious. Or because it's different. Human life is sacred because of where it comes from, God, and because of where it's going, God. Because of our origin, God, and because of our destiny, God, that's why human life is sacred. It's a gift we have on trust from God for a while, then we go back to God. We are all made in the image and likeness of God, and in that, we're all the same. We're not all the same size, we're not all the same age, we don't all have the same functions, but there's one thing in which we are all absolutely the same. We all came from the same God, we're all going to the same God. Because of our origin and our destiny, there's something infinite, transcendent about every individual made in the image and likeness of God. That image might be disguised by poverty, by circumstances, by bad health, by handicap. But underneath all of those, all of that camouflage is another one made in the image and likeness of God, just like you and me. And that's what we can't forget. Sometimes it's not the ins and outs of abortion or euthanasia or assisted suicide or just wars, as they are called. Sometimes it's not the fine points that we disagree on. Sometimes it's because we live in a society that has become forgetful that human life really is a gift from God. It's not a matter of personal ownership, like you own your shoes, you own your car, you own a pen. You don't own your life that way. Your life is something you have on trust for a while. C.S. Lewis's expression was, are you the landlord or the tenant of your existence? If you're the landlord, you can do what you want with the house, unless the environmental group in your neighborhood has other designs. But if you are the tenant, then you're only renting the place. There's a lease, there's an agreement. And we are really the tenants of our existence, not the landlords. And so, in the Catechism, after that important statement about human life is sacred, which we have to burn into our memory, because our society is becoming forgetful about that. But after we say that human life is sacred and know why human life is sacred, they take us through some of the witness of history in this regard, going all the way back really to the beginning. It too begins with the Cain and Abel incident and event, and it shows that this anger, where did this killing come from? It came out of anger and envy. Isn't that what Jesus teaches in Matthew's Gospel? You have heard from of old, thou shalt not kill. What I tell you is, don't get angry in your heart. Because often, threats of violence and the use of violence, they do come out of anger and they come out of envy. And Scripture, they say, in 22:61, is very explicit on this prohibition and how precise it is. Do not slay the innocent nor the righteous. Do not slay the innocent or the righteous. Then the Catechism takes up things that sound like they are exceptions. They're not exceptions to the prohibition, do not directly take the life of an innocent or helpless person. But this Catechism, just like the Roman Catechism of 1566, singled out certain things that don't involve a violation of the innocent. They speak about legitimate self-defense in 2263. Legitimate self-defense. That people have a right to use whatever force is necessary at the time of an attack to repel an unjust attack. If the attack is over, well, then we have no more right to attack someone, or then we would become the unjust aggressor. that if someone is being unjustly trespassed upon, violated, injured, or harmed, or even a threat to kill, there's a right to defend your own life and those who have the responsibilities for others, whether it's the police in civil society, soldiers in a war, or parents protecting their minor children. They have a right and a duty to protect them from an unjust aggressor. That's not really an exception to not kill the innocent. It's protecting the innocent, which is actually an act of virtue. That's not the only one as well, because another thing that sounds like an exception, which is hotly controverted, I think, in our society, because it is contested, and it's the Church addresses it in 2266, the so-called exception about capital punishment. I have to read exactly what the Catechism says so that I am not misunderstood. It says, the Church has acknowledged 2266 as well-founded the right and the duty of legitimate public authority to punish malefactors by means of penalties commensurate with the gravity of the crime, not excluding, in cases of extreme gravity, the death penalty. So not excluding, it means including that. Now, it's pretty clear that the bishops of our country and the Pope and many others have for a long time been arguing that this is no longer necessary. In fact, in that encyclical, Evangelium Vitae, in number 56, the Holy Father says that as the result of improvements in the penal system, such cases are very rare, if not practically non-existent. Some folks may agree with that, some may not agree with that. But the Church has never in her teaching denied the right of the state to use this as a means of societal self-defense. Many argue that it just doesn't work that way. A Catholic, I think, can be on the other side of that argument. Many of our bishops have presented serious reasons to oppose the reimposition of it. I think Catholics should look at those reasons seriously, but you can't read anyone in or out of the Church on that basis. As well, the so-called just war, which would be national self-defense, comes at the end of this chapter. The end of this chapter, we'll look at that last. Again, it's a matter of using distinctions of justifiable force or unjustifiable force under pretty rigidly considered strictures. Now, to what does violate that? Intentional homicide begins in 2268, which is really the direct killing of a moral innocent. That's really a species of murder, as would indirect. Now, it's here that the specifics come, and I think you should read the sections both on abortion and on euthanasia, and use and read along with it what the encyclical has on the same subjects, because it's much, much, much wider. There's also a handy thing on a lot of things that have to do with medical ethics called a Charter for Healthcare Workers that one of the Roman councils, the Pontifical Council for Healthcare, put out in 1995. A little summary of a lot of questions on medical ethics. It focuses on the same thing. The treatment on abortion here, numbers 2270 to 2275. Now, obviously, in just five quick paragraphs, you can't say all that is said, say, in one of our medical ethics textbooks, but it does say it very clearly that from the moment of conception, a human being must be recognized as having the rights of a person, including, first of all, the inviolable right to life, the inviolable right. That's the primordial right, the fundamental right. Because if you lose that right, well, your other rights don't mean anything. It takes us through some history in the Didache, in the teaching, all the way from the beginning through the Middle Ages up to Pope Paul VI, who taught, as the Catechism taught, that the Church's prohibition against direct abortion is unchanged and unchangeable. So if someone should ask, is this going to change? The answer is no. It is unchanged through history, and it is unchangeable. Now, that's the moral teaching, not the canonical or the criminal. Have the sanctions or the penalties changed sometimes in canon law, sometimes in civil law? Yeah, we've seen it in our own lifetime. It used to be the crime of homicide to commit an abortion. Now, someone says it's a constitutional right. Obviously, the penalty has changed in our civil law system, but the morality has not changed. In fact, the Catechism does something that's a little bit surprising. It starts to get pretty explicit on cooperation in the canonical sense, in the Code of Canon Law, about those who formally cooperate, who cooperate in a necessary way, namely those whose cooperation, without which this could not be done, are guilty of the same crime and penalty as someone who procures the direct abortion. And that means excommunication. And that's an automatic excommunication if someone's participation, namely if the abortion would not have taken place without this person's close assistance, their necessary cooperation, they're just as guilty as the prime perpetrator in the first place. We distinguish in Catholic teaching between direct abortion and indirect, because there are some cases of genuine problems, like the famous case of a woman who has cancer of the uterus very early on in the pregnancy, 2 months, 2.5 months, and the cancer is starting to metastasize. And by the application of the principle of double effect, we're removing a diseased organ, we foresee two effects, one good, one evil. The good is not coming precisely through the death of the unborn, and there's a proportion for doing that. That would be done in a Catholic hospital, but we call that an indirect abortion, because the direct cause and the direct intention is this health-saving procedure, and there's no other solution to it. Similarly with the ectopic pregnancies, which would be performed in a Catholic hospital. But all the ones that are direct, that's really what directly intended, directly caused. Technically, that's a moral species of murder. At the other end, which we couldn't possibly explain in great explicitness, but we'll try to come back to, the question of euthanasia comes up in 2276, 2279. It amazes me that in four paragraphs, this catechism says concisely what the Church is teaching. And it's important here that we not be misunderstood. Very often, at the end of life, two questions are asked and two answers that are given that are no use at all. One says, do everything for everyone all the time. Can't be done. It's not useful information. The others, do nothing because they can't get better. That's abandonment. In between those two extremes, the Church's tradition is to do all things that are ordinary. We use ordinary means, ordinary treatments, ordinary procedures. And what are they? They offer a reasonable hope of benefit to this patient without a serious danger of death, and without any excessive pain, excessive hardship, excessive burden. If a treatment or an operation or a procedure offers a reasonable hope of benefit without those negatives, that treatment for that patient is ordinary. If it doesn't offer a reasonable hope of benefit, or it's kind of 50-50, you'll come out alive, or it has this disproportionately invasive hardship that's excessive, then that's extraordinary. The Catholic rule is kind of simple. Ordinary means obligatory. Extraordinary means it's optional. You want to do it, you go ahead and do it. But if you don't want to do it, you don't have to do it. That distinction between ordinary and extraordinary, great precision was brought to that by Pope Pius XII in a famous talk of his on November 24th back in 1957. But he didn't invent it. It's about 400 years old. And that's the same position, say, as the stated ethics of the American Medical Association. It's in accord with all our civil laws. And I believe it's in accord with all other religions. And this teaching is a common sense one, which we have to do on a case-by-case basis. And it's important in the euthanasia argument. Don't try to defend what's indefensible. And the Church's teaching here is not only rational, but it's good medicine and it's good law. We make distinctions case by case. Nobody is obliged to do what's extraordinary, but we are obliged to do what's ordinary, because the failure to do what's ordinary would actually be suicide or assisting a suicide. It's that last one that comes up next in 2280 to 2283. And that's a suicide which is actually the kind of soft underbelly of the euthanasia movement in our country. Suicide is not a crime in any of our states. Or if it is, there's no penalty. Fair enough. If you attempt suicide and succeed, there's no sense talking about penalties. If you attempt suicide and you fail, you don't belong in prison. You need help. You need a cup of coffee. You need to see some light at the end of the tunnel. You need assistance. You need a reason for living. Now, the trick is, civilly, about two-thirds of our states have laws against assisting suicide. Assisting suicide. And that's what currently is under review in our judicial system. That's what's being tested to the limits by people like Dr. Kevorkian and Dr. Timothy Quill. And that's why I call it the soft underbelly of of the euthanasia movement, because it's meant to convey the notion of mercy and help. And again, you get into that innocuous terminology. As the Holy Father points out in Evangelium Vitae, it's really false mercy because it's false compassion. Compassion means, passio in Latin means suffer, suffer with, help someone carry a burden. What you're doing here, instead of helping someone with a burden, is getting rid of suffering that seems to burden you. And that's a false mercy. That's a false solution. We offer all ordinary means, sometimes witness, sometimes holding hands, sometimes relieving pain. There really is a case-by-case solution. But changing the law, legalizing what is really against divine revelation, changing the medical profession from a curing, where they can't cure, to at least care, changing that into killers, that will not improve or enhance our society. So at least on this front part of the Fifth Commandment, we'll come back to the rest. The negative part, thou shalt not kill, meaning not directly take the life of the innocent, this is an absolute prohibition, and it's something that we have to oppose. The positive part we will return to, because there's at least 101 ways we can live this commandment positively.
Join us again next time for Catholic Morality and the Catechism on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.